Is your job about to get automated?
Should we bar robots from being used?
There's a growing premium on the society's ability to civically innovate at the same rate that we technologically innovate.
Human beings are a disease.
Humans couldn't compete on what they superseded.
I'm sorry, Dave. I'm afraid I can't do that.
From the offices of Civic Ventures in downtown Seattle, this is The Other Washington, a podcast on policy and politics from outside the Beltway.
Way outside the Beltway.
Far from the pundits and politicos who dominate the national debate. I'm Paul Constant.
And I'm David Goldstein.
And each episode, we'll be taking you on a deep dive into a single policy issue, explaining how it works,
how it doesn't,
and how conventional politics often gets in the way of implementing effective policy.
Welcome to episode 3, The Coming Robot Apocalypse.
I was trying to think of something I could say there.
Other than
bleep, bloop, bleep. You know.
In our first episode, we talked about the minimum wage. And whenever you bring up the issue of the minimum wage, there's always the conservatives who come back and say, oh, no, if you raise wages, you're going to get fewer jobs because you're going to incentivize employers to automate jobs and the robots are coming for you.
In fact, Marco Rubio just said that in the fourth Republican presidential debate.
If you raise the minimum wage, you're going to make people more expensive than a machine. And that means all this automation that's replacing jobs and people right now is only going to be accelerated.
Of course, there are actually two different visions of the robotic dystopia.
That's the Terminator and the Matrix.
Human beings are a disease, a cancer of this planet. You are a plague. And we... The cure.
But that's one vision. That's the robot apocalypse in which super intelligent, self-aware machines take over the planet, enslave mankind, or perhaps eliminate us. Some call that the singularity, and it's something that tech visionary Elon Musk has warned is humankind's biggest existential threat.
I think we should be very careful about artificial intelligence. If I were to guess at what our biggest existential threat is, it's probably that. So we need to be very careful with artificial intelligence. I'm increasingly inclined to think that there should be some regulatory oversight at the international and international level just to make sure that we don't do something very foolish. I mean, with artificial intelligence, we are summoning the demon. You know all those stories where there's the guy with the pentagram and the holy water, and he's like, yeah, you sure you can control the demon? Didn't work out.
But we're not going to worry about that today because we're nowhere near making the leap from self-driving cars to self-aware ones.
Siri has been getting a little saucy lately, though.
Saucy, maybe, but I've never quite understood why we should expect the singularity to be malevolent. I think that reflects poorly on humankind, not robots. But of more immediate concern is the second robotic dystopia, a viciously unequal job-scarce future in which the robots have taken all our jobs.
The robots will flip your burgers.
I'll be back.
So this is less about Terminator and the Matrix and more about Blade Runner and that awful Matt Damon movie Elysium.
Exactly.
Immediate extension of parole duration by a further
8
months.
Wait, what? No.
Elevation in heart rate detected. Wouldn't you like a pill?
No, I am okay. Thank you.
Are you being sarcastic and or abusive?
Negative.
And it's what opponents of the minimum wage constantly warn of whenever we bring up the $15 issue. If you raise wages too high, too quickly, the robots are going to come and take away your jobs. So I can imagine mankind choosing a dystopic future. I'm not an optimist, but I do know a paradox when I see one. And Rubio's argument is a paradox. On the one hand, he's arguing that automation is going to cost us jobs. On the other hand, automation is all about productivity. And productivity is how we drive economic growth. And economic growth is what Rubio says creates jobs. So he can't, on the one hand, call for policies that will increase productivity and generate economic growth as a cure for what's ailing working and middle-class Americans. And then on the other hand, say that, well, if we raise wages, that's going to cost Americans their jobs. Because raising wages increases productivity, automation increases productivity, and all of that is for the public good. There's kind of a second paradox in terms of automation, and that is that robots don't eat. You can't have robotic burger flippers if there's nobody left who can afford to buy burgers. And that's what you get with Rubio's idea that higher wages are going to lead to automation, which is going to lead to fewer jobs. If there are no jobs, there's no demand for burgers. If there's no demand for burgers, there's no demand for robotic burger flippers. The fundamental issue here that people have to keep in mind is that economics is a choice. We are going to get automation, we're going to get robotics, and over the long course of human history, over the long course of our economy, that should be a good thing because it will make us more productive, more comfortable, safer, healthier, happier, have more leisure time, all that. But only if we distribute the benefits of automation equitably enough, not evenly, not equally, but equitably enough so that we can maintain demand, we can maintain consumption, and we can maintain a high quality of life for all Americans and not just for those at the very top.
Hi, I'm Nick Hanauer, and I'm founder of Civic Ventures.
Why should we listen to you about robots as opposed to, say, somebody who is at the forefront of robot technology at MIT?
Oh, jeeps. I don't know. That's a good question. I mean, I think that it is much easier intellectually to see the future in dystopian terms than in optimistic terms because it is far easier to see the effects of disruption than to imagine the future that change will bring. And so people freak out that all the jobs will disappear when, for instance, cars are self-driving, right? There are 3.5 million truck drivers, for instance, in the country. And it is certainly true that at some point in the future, there probably won't be people driving trucks, and one wonders what will happen to all those truck drivers. But the thing about the economy is that it will produce new opportunities as surely as humans continue to want to improve their circumstance. To use a goofy and prosaic example, like there are 350,000 people in the massage business in the United States, but the penetration of massages is only about 10%. If we had an economy where everyone could afford a massage, you could very easily imagine 3.5 million people in the massage business absorbing virtually all of those truck drivers. Obviously some truck drivers probably don't want to be masseuses, there are infinite possibilities in the economy, and you certainly 30 years ago you would never have predicted there would be 30,000 yoga studios in the country, but here we are. You would have never considered the possibility that there would be YouTube stars earning millions of dollars, but here we are. And at a minimum, in an economy that is changing at an ever increasing pace, the premium on education and on essentially re-education, teaching people new skills, goes up massively. And so you can easily imagine, for instance, double the number of people devoted to teaching in our society that currently are today. So, I have zero worry that we're going to run out of things to do, but of course there will be profound challenges about managing these transitions proactively and making sure that we don't leave huge classes of people behind because we don't have the foresight to think through these disruptions. There's this conceit that, the manufacturing jobs that we used to have were good jobs or better jobs or higher value jobs than the service jobs that we have today. And this is simply not true. It is simply not true that an auto worker building cars 50 years ago was better trained than a barista at Starbucks, or that the company that that auto worker worked for created more value than Starbucks, or that it was more profitable than Starbucks. The only difference was the split between workers and owners in terms of wages. The only difference really is that the auto worker had a union and the service workers don't. And that in the past, unions essentially solved the collective action problem of wages in the manufacturing business. And we have not yet found a way to solve the collective action problem of low wages in service jobs. But of course, Starbucks and Walmart and Walgreens and all these service companies that mostly are holding wages down could easily pay much more. And indeed, products might cost a tiny bit more as a consequence of that. But the entire society would be better off because close to twice as many people would be able to robustly participate in the economy. And we'd all have to pay much less in tax to support the programs that those folks currently depend on, not to mention the myriad and subsidiary costs of poverty that we bear as a society because so many people are struggling. It's just stupid the way we handle this thing today, and it's very easy to solve this problem by slowly but surely increasing the minimum wage to a reasonable level.
So using the example of grocery store workers, the grocery store brings in a couple aisles of automated checkout tellers, and those workers are out of work. And so whose responsibility is it to make sure that those workers can, you know, feed and clothe their families and in the transition period in between finding a new job or hopefully, you know, getting better educated and finding better work?
Or different work, yeah. Whatever it is. Yeah. And so ultimately, it's everyone's responsibility. I mean, to be clear, virtually everyone in the world, certainly in our country, is facing the possibility that their job may be automated, which should give everyone incentive to make sure that we have systems in place to ensure that people whose jobs are automated find a happy and relatively comfortable way to transition to some new form of work.
All right, I'm Tina Knoll.
I'm Nick Casella.
And we are standing outside in the freezing cold on the corner of 45th and 4th Avenue in Seattle, Washington, about to step into a brand new sort of, I don't know, Nick, innovative company?
Yeah, they call it a retail incubator. The name is Hointer.
And at first glance, it looks like a lot of tablets and things where maybe you can just buy your clothes at a store without even talking to a sales associate. But I'm not sure that's it.
It doesn't look like your normal shop.
My name is Nadia Shorobora, and I'm a founder and CEO of Hointer. Hointer is a startup, a bricks and mortar startup poised to change how we shop in traditional bricks and mortar stores. And we have our own store, but we mostly work in partnership with Macy's, changing our Macy's stores to be the store of the future for all customers to shop for bras and swimwear and active and other hard-to-fit and hard-to-buy items. You know, when I opened my store, Hointer, and I opened in a traditional way, I thought that as a stylist, I will be working with customers and styling them. But I never had a chance to do that because I was always busy cleaning. So what we've done is we created this very efficient system which allows associates to be very efficient. So associate has a lot more time shopping with customers. In our Macy's, you come in and there is always several people greeting you and they're there to do nothing but help you.
So this created jobs.
I think where it is it creates a new type of a job, which is a stylist. And I think for in a new era of shops and importance of shops where items can be tried on and touched and feel, and where instead of buying online, you would rather go to the store and talk to associate, it's really important to have this new type of a job, which is a stylist.
I guess kind of not related to Hoynter, but you're clearly on the cutting edge of technology and its application in everyday use. And one of the things that we're dealing with this podcast is a lot of people with technology are very they view it in a very negative light, that it's going to take away jobs, that, you know, you lose that human interaction. What have your experiences been like? I mean, you must be confronted with those opinions quite a bit. What do you respond? Are you very optimistic about automation and the future of jobs?
Yeah, what I tell to those people is they should try and go and work in one of any stores and be an associate for a day. And what they will face is piles of clothes need to be folded. Lots of prices need to be restickered. Displays need to be cleaned. Customers screaming from a fitting room, and it's a horrible experience for associate. You go to the fitting room, and I launched it as a men's store. You go to the fitting room. I have to open a curtain. I have to give my customer, who is most likely naked in a fitting room, an item. Super uncomfortable for me, super uncomfortable for him. So it's a really bad experience for a sales associate. What I wanted to do as a sales associate is style customers and help them. And to me, it's very important to change the role of an associate from somebody who is cleaning and running around to somebody who is styling and who knows the fashion and who helps customers to find the fit. So that's what I would say to folks who think of it as a negative. Try working as an associate. All our associates love that they can focus on customer experience. Shopping bags, they weigh down her arms.
Popping tags and collars, her charms. So, Paul, you feeling a little more comfortable about the coming robot apocalypse?
Yes, I am feeling a little more comfortable. At least I know that the folding clothes robots will probably not be as formidable as some of the movies that I've seen.
Okay, yeah. My name is Zach Silk. I'm the president of Civic Ventures, and we spend a lot of time thinking about robots and automation because we spend a lot of time thinking about the future of political economy, and we think that this topic will end up having a big impact on what policymaking is in the future. So, you know, I think we here think a lot about matching, you know, when you're going to have these technological innovations that are going to create disruption, you need to match it with civic innovations that are going to help soften the blow of those disruptions. And I think the best lesson you can learn is that there was obviously a we've done this already in the history of America and really throughout most of the Western capitalist world, where you're matching social programs, policy making, and education to sync up with the economy as it's evolving. And probably, I think one of the easy things to look at is there was obviously the industrialization of the American economy that happened in the 19th century. There were a lot of bad outcomes that were related to that. Obviously there was tremendous child labor. There were terrible labor standards in most of these places. We've all heard about the kinds of things that would happen in meatpacking plants or in industrial environments where people were dying. They were working really long hours. You had child labor. You had women labor that weren't even being paid to compensate. And that was all. There was a recognition. There was a very disruptive, as you had steam technology and modern industrial technology insert itself into the economy, that was very disruptive to the agricultural economy that was prior to that. But The way that we ended up sorting that out is we had a series of real civic innovations that came in, which was to say we had policymakers get together and recognize that we needed to raise labor standards, we needed to set boundaries on what was acceptable behavior inside the economy, and we needed to protect the vulnerable. And at the same time, we needed an education system that could prepare people not for agricultural experiences, but could prepare them well for a modern industrial economy. So you had big changes in the way that the education system would work, including, of course, bringing people into a school classroom, having them learn basic skills, being able to be able to do basic math, basic writing, read and understand instruction. All of that happened in response to what was the industrialization of the economy. And then obviously you had all the standards that came in, the fair labor standards, minimum wages. And so that combo of civic innovation really allowed for then a massive outpouring of probably the greatest growth that we'd ever seen in the history of mankind, which was the post-war growth in the United States and the growth of the middle class was probably the moment, if you had to really think about it, where you had the nearest nexus of ideal economic disruption and technological leap with civic innovation. And then everybody benefited. You had massive growth for the private sector. You had gains in education, gains in standards of living, gains in wages. You had the explosion of the modern American middle class. And so that moment is really when you calibrate really great economic disruption and growth with really smart civic innovation that bounds it and guides it, you get great things happen.
So my name is Brad Kreit. I'm a research director with Institute for the Future, a California-based research firm that does long-range tenure forecasting across a whole wide variety of areas. I've led recent work on the future of automation. I have led some work on technology in cities, and I'm currently leading work on the future of communications technology.
We're working out of Nick Hanauer's shop, Civic Ventures. It's a policy and messaging shop in Seattle. And we have this freedom to just kind of look at problems and see how we might creatively solve them. We've started these podcasts. We've got a couple in the can already. And the first one we did was on minimum wage, which is one of the issues we've been most involved in. Nick was at the forefront of pushing for a $15 an hour minimum wage. Obviously, we passed that in Seattle. We were the first major city to do that. And in the process of making this argument, one of the things that people push back on is that, oh, if you raise the cost of employment, then you're just going to drive employers to automate and you're going to lose more jobs more quickly. In fact, there's a quote from Bill Gates on this.
You have to be a bit careful that if you raise the minimum wage, you're encouraging labor substitution, that you're going to go buy machines and automate things or cause jobs to appear outside of that jurisdiction.
Do you see that in your 10-year forecast? Is that a fear?
People have been saying that for forever. You can go back hundreds of years and find, any number of quotes from people about fear of automation, fear of job loss, and that kind of thing. We want to try to figure out how do we encourage us to figure out what machines do well and what people do well and sort of find the right balance of the two.
The period we're going through now, obviously, the rate of technological change has been increasing, or at least it appears obvious to me. Are we in a different era, or are we entering a different era where those old rules might change?
I think what's different is things can spread so quickly that expertise, skills, jobs that might have felt incredibly secure now seem threatened in ways we wouldn't have ever anticipated even a few years ago. But on the other hand, I don't think it means that there's not a role for people. I think it just means we're going to have to think very differently about what the role is for people in certain.
All right, you can have an app for diagnosing the potential of cancer, but you're still going to end up, first thing you do is call the doctor.
Right, exactly. I think that's the point, is that, you know, and there are a lot of people, you know, Vinod Khosla, the venture capitalist, the founder of Sun Microsystems, a couple of years ago made a lot of headlines for saying that, the time he said, by 2030, 80% of what doctors do could, in theory, be automated. You know, something like that. And he sort of put it out as much as a provocation as anything else. And I think that's sort of useful for thinking about, because it does help us sort of think about what do we really, you know, need in terms of human labor, what do we want. But I think at the same time, it's a bit misleading, or it doesn't highlight the fact that there are all these other different ways that we can, as people, create value for each other.
Right.
And that, you know, just by focusing on what can be automated, we can lose sight of what we can do for each other. I think what we see in the long run with labor substitution and automation is that over time, people go from doing rote tasks to being able to do more complex tasks, more enjoyable, more rewarding, more meaningful tasks. Now, in the short run, if your job is automated, that's all well and good in theory, but in practice, that sucks for you. That's really hard, and it's a really difficult thing to deal with. And I think when we think about it at a social level, that's sort of, you know, the thing we need to keep in mind is that, you know, in the long run, automation technologies free people up to do better work, to do more valuable work, to do more meaningful work. But in the short run, they can be really painful. And so we really need to prepare for both of those things and enable people to retrain and reskill and find different opportunities.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.
My name is Esther Dyson. I am the executive founder of The Way to Wellville, which is a nonprofit that is trying to produce health in 5 communities and show what kind of business model would actually work. I used to be a techie conference organizer, wrote a newsletter called Release 1.0 and lots of other stuff.
And you have a reputation. I don't know if you like the term as a bit of a futurist, because you've
I hate the term.
That's my understanding.
I try to understand the present.
I know that's my understanding. So I won't use that. But you have had a good track record in terms of looking at present technology and seeing where it's going in the future. You know, one of the issues that we've been talking about, when we bring up the issue of the minimum wage, we get this pushback from opponents who say, oh, if you raise the cost of employment, then you're just going to push employers to move to automation and it's going to put people out of jobs. And I know one of the issues you've been looking at is one of the technologies is self-driving cars. How far away do you think that is before that's a reality?
This is a clear one where, for safety and efficiency and a lot of other reasons, it actually makes huge sense to replace people. On the other end, in things like giving care to other people in retail stores, customer support, and, of course, education, I think people and personal touch and human beings are more important than ever. Precisely because you get so much stuff done automatically, but it's that human element that still motivates people. And I would have no problem with seeing a country in which half the people were employed taking care of the other half of the people and doing that effectively.
And over the long course of market capitalism from the start of the Industrial Revolution, we've been replacing workers with new technologies, and our standard of living has been rising broadly and steadily, if in fits and starts, for some people.
Right. And we've also been adding new jobs.
Right. So let's go back a little bit to the self-driving cars, because this is an issue that gets brought up a lot. Obviously, there's a lot of controversy over Uber and the gig economy and how disruptive Uber has been. Clearly, Uber is looking at a future of self-driving cars. There's, you know, depending on your estimates, 300,000-500,000 people making a full or part-time living from driving cabs or from ride-hailing services. And there are about 3.5 million truck drivers. What's the future hold for them with these emerging technologies?
yeah, it holds for them different jobs. And yes, I mean, this does not happen without disruption. But at the same time, now people can get to work much more easily. So it might not have been cost effective to have the fancy hairdresser or the mental therapist or the person to mind your kids show up at your doorstep, or it might not be cost effective for you to go there to their office, but now it will be. So you can deliver more personal services that are of higher value than just ferrying people around.
It's funny, there was an article in a local business magazine about the impact of the $15 minimum wage on the restaurant industry in Seattle. And there's a quote from a cook who says that this higher wage turns cooking into a craft.
That's great. And it's often true. I go to many places where you have a whole bunch of low-wage people running around, and the coordination costs are so high that they're less effective than they could be. Certainly, this means we need to do a much better job of educating people to do personal services jobs better. And the first set of jobs is going to be jobs teaching people and training people to do some of these new things.
So what have we learned from all this?
So in our first two podcasts, we focused on issues that we understood really well, minimum wage and gun responsibility, for which we already have a clear idea of what type of policies we need to pursue to advance the issue. This episode was a little different, and I'd say harder for us, in that rather than it being an explanation of an issue, it was more of an exploration. And I think what I learned is that I have this confidence that we can't use this excuse of automation and robots to not do things like raise wages. This is going to happen over the long run, and over the long run we've seen that automation has been a net plus for humans all over the world. It has been responsible for largely raising living standards and so forth. But just because it went that way over the long course of history, over the past 200 or so years, doesn't necessarily mean that it will improve lives over the long run if we don't make the right choices. And so that's my long-winded take, Paul. What did you learn from all this?
Well, to go back a little further into Pollyanna territory, I think that something that's really important about this is that you don't want to cave to fear of automation just because it's something that, you know, that it's a tactic that politicians and business owners use to keep people in line. It's a reason why people say they don't think they should raise the minimum wage. But the truth is, they know as little or likely even less than we do about this. And so they are threatening with a possibility. And so I think, like you said, it's really important to know that we have a choice moving forward, but also that that nobody has all the answers. The Other Washington is a production of Civic Skunk Works. Thanks to our guests, Nadia Shorabora, Bradley Kreit, Esther Dyson, Zach Silk, and our benevolent plutocratic overlord, Nick Hanna.
This show is produced by Tina Knoll at Large Media with help from Nick Casella. Our assistant editor and make us sound good engineer is Shelley Goncharowski.
Find us on social media at Civic Skunk Works on Twitter and Facebook.
You can visit our blog at civicskunkworks.com, where you can also subscribe to the show. You can also go to iTunes or Stitcher or wherever you get your podcast.
Thanks for listening.